From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump says he will defy Democrats' demands and prevent former White House counsel Don McGahn from testifying before Congress because the Russia investigation is over. The president spoke on Fox News last night.
They've gone through everything, and I'm so clean. Think of it. After 2.5 years and all of that money spent, nothing.
It is Friday, and it was a busy week in politics, so let's bring in our roundtable. Tolu Olorunipah is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, good to speak with you again.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC and MSNBC. Beth, good to speak with you.
And you as well.
Beth, I'm going to give you the chance to highlight the best moment of the week for you. Was it the empty chair in the White House committee room set aside for the Attorney General William Barr? The bucket of fried chicken that one Democrat bought to the hearing to mock the Attorney General, or something else altogether?
Yeah, chicken. Get it? you know, it's really very troubling, I have to say, though, Peter, given the seriousness of what we're dealing with here.
Right.
I mean, the president was found by Robert Mueller's report to be at least attempting to obstruct on many occasions throughout the whole Russia probe. It was made very clear in that report. Attorney General Barr was evidently asked in his role as chief law enforcement officer of the United States to essentially defend President Trump and not act independently. Republicans, including Lindsey Graham, who have previously been extremely critical of President Trump, or at least candidate Trump back in the day, were left saying that it's time to reopen Hillary Clinton's email investigation. Not only that, but we've definitely seen an indecision on the Democrats' part about how to proceed going forward. Jerry Nadler, the head of House Oversight, very much wanting to potentially call Attorney General Barr under contempt or perhaps subpoena his appearance before the House because of that empty chair. Nancy Pelosi, very troubled by Barr's decision not to come to testify before the House, and yet still saying she's not interested in an impeachment proceedings. There's a real decision that Democrats have to make about how far they want to pursue this Mueller report and Barr's appearance before it, or is it time to move on and just time to move on to some other issues?
Well, let's hear from the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who is referring to Barr's performance here at her press conference yesterday.
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the president of the United States and not the attorney general.
So, Tolu, yes, this is serious. And it does look like there are some negotiations going on today between the House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler, who is saying that he'll now give Barr until 9 a.m. Monday to respond. And this is for that request for the unredacted version of the Mueller report. But what do you think? We get to Monday. What happens? Are we still headed toward contempt proceedings?
All indications appear that that's where we're headed. This does seem to be the early stages of what could be a constitutional crisis, a clash between the various branches of government. You have the House Speaker saying that the Attorney General within the executive branch has lied to Congress and committed a crime. You have the Attorney General in some ways behaving more like the president's personal attorney and really stonewalling Democrats in the House and not wanting to provide information, not wanting to provide testimony, and really giving the president language that can help him say that he's been vindicated and exonerated by the Mueller report, when the actual Mueller report was much more damaging for the president and painted a very damning picture of how the president operated behind closed doors and all of the various attempts that he made to obstruct justice, mm-hmm. according to the Mueller report.
Beth, how
so
many?
We
yeah.
could be.
Go ahead.
We could be very close to that kind of a clash taking place between the Congress and the executive branch.
As far as that contempt charge goes or the proceedings go, Republicans tried to do this with Eric Holder during the Obama administration. He refused to turn over documents during the Fast and Furious ATF gunwalking scandal. Beth, is it all that meaningful or is it more political in this case?
Well, Congress does have a job to do, which is to do oversight on the executive branch. That's part of its role. So Congressman Nadler and others are not wrong to want to pursue a track on this. The question is the political nature of this starting to overtake the oversight nature of
Right.
this? We've got an incredibly polarized Congress right now, of course, we have polarized voters. Nobody's minds are being changed by any of this. Most polling shows that voters want to move on. They don't think that President Trump came out of this scot-free, but they don't want an impeachment proceeding to go ahead. The presidential candidates, the Democrats out on the hustings, are very eager to talk about other things. They don't want to talk about the Russia probe. Voters aren't bringing it up. So it really leaves Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats in the House in particular at a crossroads. What to do? Do you just move on and basically give carte blanche to the next president to undertake activities of this kind and not exercise oversight? Strong oversight, or perhaps launch impeachment because it's not what people want. It's really a hard place for them.
Right. The president tweeted praise this morning for a New York Times article that he claims is proof of efforts to spy on his campaign. The story says the FBI sent an undercover informant to question his campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos. And on Fox News this morning, Vice President Mike Pence called this troubling.
We've got to get to the bottom of how all this started. I mean, the American people have a right to know how this investigation even began. And as the attorney general said when he testified before Congress, there was spying.
Tolu, it is good fodder for the president's supporters.
Yeah, we're going to continue to hear the president and his campaign sort of play the victim here and say that they were the victims of an improper spying campaign by the FBI. But when the vice president says, you know, we need to find out how this all originated, there's ample evidence about how this investigation started. One of President Trump's foreign policy advisors on his campaign spoke to a foreign official about information that he believed that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton, and that foreign government provided that information to the FBI and said, listen, there's someone in the Trump campaign who appears to have information about dirt from the Russians on Hillary Clinton, and that caused the investigation to be launched. And I think that there's been so much information and so many investigations already by House Republicans in the past Congress about this effort that it's pretty clear why the investigation started, but the Trump administration and the Trump campaign want to focus on some of the negative things that they can associate with the FBI about, you know, spying allegations from the attorney general and claims that President Trump was the victim of the smear campaign by the FBI. So they do have some fodder that they've gotten from people like Attorney General Barr, who said that he wants to investigate how this all began. But I do believe that there's been so many different investigations already that have shown a clear nexus between what the Trump campaign was doing in terms of its multiple links with the Russian government and Russian officials and the FBI's decision to launch a counterintelligence investigation, in part because of all of those links, which were, we have to remember, unprecedented in terms of the number of links between a foreign adversary and a presidential campaign.
We had a chance to see how some of the Democratic candidates for the White House in 2020 were going to handle this. I want to hear some tape. This is from earlier in the week in the Senate when the Attorney General was answering questions from senators. Here's California Senator Kamala Harris, a candidate, who was questioning the Attorney General about his four-page summary of the Mueller report.
My question is, in reaching your conclusion, did you personally review all of the underlying evidence?
No, we took and accepted
Mr. Rosenstein?
No, we accepted the statements in the report as the factual record.
Beth, some people are saying this is good exposure for candidate Kamala Harris. What do you think?
Yeah, well, she also did a similar job of grilling then Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, of course, and that highlighted her skills as a prosecutor, and those were on display again this week with Attorney General Barr. Look, Kamala Harris has been, you know, considered a top tier candidate throughout this process, although sort of her visibility's dropped a little bit
in
recent weeks. Some of the polling that we've seen come out, especially since Vice President Joe Biden joined the field, shows her, you know, really not kind of up in the top three or so of candidates. But, you know, it's still early. She's drawing good crowds out in the field as an African-American woman candidate. She is definitely drawn interest from many African-American voters who, of course, are the heart and soul of the Democratic primary and will probably determine who the nominee is going to be. So she's got plenty of upside potential. And this appearance this week in the Senate with A.G. Barr is probably giving her another breath of life at this point.
Tolu, there had been some rumblings that high-profile women in this race, like Kamala Harris, like Elizabeth Warren, are not getting anywhere near the coverage that some of the white men were, Biden, Sanders, Buttigieg, for instance. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a fair criticism? Are the women getting a fair shake here?
Well, we saw in 2016 that women running for president face a higher bar and face more scrutiny about whether it's their looks or the way they speak or questions about authenticity and ability to connect with voters. And I don't think that much has changed, but we have seen multiple women jump into this race, and some of them are starting to gain more traction and starting to get more attention about specifically their policy goals. If you look at Senator Elizabeth Warren, for example, she's been a front runner when it comes to putting out policy ideas and putting out different types of prescriptions for how to deal with various problems. Yeah. And I think that we're starting to see her catch a little bit of fire in because she has multiple plans.
Tolu Olorunipov with the Washington Post. And Beth Fooey, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last week, we looked at an effort to close a trash incinerator in Baltimore. Burning garbage to generate power in the U.S. is controversial. Most incinerators were built decades ago, and they're blamed for health problems and pollution. But in Europe, they're more accepted. They're newer, and they're arguably cleaner. In Copenhagen, Denmark, a new incinerator designed by a famed architect sits conspicuously in the city center, turning garbage into heat since 2017. It also has a ski slope on top. Peter Blinksberg is a chief engineer at Ammager Resource Center, and he joins us now. Peter, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
All but one of the 75 or so trash incinerators here in the United States are older, and they had to be retrofitted with modern pollution controls in the 1990s to meet our standards. But what is the difference between an older generation waste-to-energy plant and the one that you're operating there in Copenhagen?
I would say there are two key issues that differs. First of all, it's when you come to the old plants, it's the boiler efficiency. A bad combustion process gives a lot of organic micropollutants like dioxins that has to be removed. The other objective is that the flue gas cleaning is much more efficient. And besides that, it takes out extra heat from the flue gas, which we in Denmark can sell for district heating.
Now, as you say, there are dangerous chemicals that are associated with burning garbage no matter how you do it. Things like mercury, formaldehyde, nitrogen oxide, or NOx. So tell me more how you're making that burning more efficient so that in theory, it sounds like you're saying less of those pollutants are going into the air.
The organics like dioxins or formaldehyde or benzene has to be burned out through the combustion process. So it comes out as CO2 and water vapor instead of coming out as dangerous pollutants. By doing that, we will produce a lot of NOxes because high efficient combustion process will give by nature high NOx emissions. Therefore, we have to have a very good and efficient NOx cleaning equipment.
Scrubbers.
Yeah, we use a catalyst. So you have a catalytic reaction between NOx and we inject ammonia. Then ammonia and NOx react to nitrogen and water.
Even if you're scrubbing those chemicals out of the process, you're still releasing some emissions. Environmental groups say that even these high-tech plants will release dioxins, which are very dangerous, cancer-causing chemicals that build up in the body.
Yes, but we cannot measure any. They might be there, but they are below the detection limit of the laboratory who do the sampling and analysis.
It's that low, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But doesn't the pollution have to go somewhere, even if you scrub it out? The ash, for instance, that's left over.
The ash, yes, of course, you have some ash, but the main part of ash is actually the same as sand. It's silicium oxide, but there is, of course, pollutants in it, and it can be reused. Some of it can and some of it cannot.
What do you do with the bad stuff?
the bad stuff. The worst stuff is the bottom edge, because it's the most part of it. We have a contract with a company who comes and take it, and they take out the free metals, iron, alumina, and they can sell that for remelting and reuse. What is left is ash, and the main part of the ash is silicon oxide, and it can replace construction material for road building, for instance.
Goes into roads. In this country, a lot of it ends up in a landfill.
Yeah.
On a visit that I took to a waste-to-energy plant, an incinerator in Baltimore, I saw a lot of materials getting burned, thrown into the fire, that could have been recycled or composted. Do you have that problem in Copenhagen?
We are working on it. Of course, we still have something that could be recycled or composted, but you will always end up with something that cannot be recycled or will be, at least at the moment, very expensive to recycle.
Do you have to import waste from other countries for your plant to work out?
Yeah, we do. But we import waste from, for instance, UK. The waste we import will normally be landfilled. And therefore, it's much better for the environment that it's combusted.
Well, the argument is that it will release methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, in a landfill. It will not do that if it's thrown into an incinerator. But if you're bringing it from the United Kingdom to Denmark, there's a huge carbon footprint there just to get it to the continent.
We do it by ship. It's not that far. Europe is not that big. No, but we have done a little calculating on it. The carbon footprint is not that big from the transport from UK to Denmark.
There are hundreds of plants like yours across Europe. They were built after an EU directive for member states to reduce waste in landfills for the reasons we just discussed. Yeah. Is there more political will in Europe to build these plants, do you think? A different philosophy about trash where you are?
Well, it's difficult to say because the political scene are changing. I don't know really what's happening. So there's a lot of politicians also in Denmark that wants to be have zero combustion. But when we look into the figures and see how much can be reused and recirculated, we end up with a rather large fraction that has to be done something with, either landfilled or burned in a waste incinerator.
Do you believe the plant you're operating is safer than the incinerators in the United States?
Well, I have not seen the plants in the United States, but I will assume that you have larger emissions than we have. And if that's a question of safety, then yes, we perform better, I think.
That's Peter Blinksberg, chief engineer of a trash incinerator, a new high-tech trash incinerator in Copenhagen. He's with Amager Resource Center. Peter, thanks for speaking with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And these days, high school seniors often learn if they've been accepted by their dream college via email during class. The timing can be overwhelming for someone waiting for a decision that will decide their future. As Kate McGee from member station WBEZ reports, technology and social media are changing the college decision experience.
Nick Joy has a routine when he opens his email these days.
I close my eyes before and then I open my eyes. And just in case, like, there's like an email from a college and I'm like, oh my God, is this it?
Joy is telling this to his fellow seniors at the Chicago High School for the Arts. They're sitting in a circle, checking in with each other about college. They were starting to hear back from schools, and there was a lot of uncertainty, says senior Stephanie Galicia.
There's this whole pressure of, like, you need to have everything figured out right now, and if you don't, well, then you're not going to succeed.
That pressure is felt by students and parents alike, as made clear by the recent college admission scandal, in which parents have been charged with using bribery and fraud to get their children into top schools. And it's a pressure that's existed for decades. But social media and technology have changed the way students hear from schools and share news with friends. Nick Joy says these days, everything is publicized.
And everything is, like, you know, on Instagram. Like, I scroll through my feed and I see people posting pictures of screenshots of their acceptances. And I'm like, oh my God, like, it's overwhelming.
Let's start with how schools send decisions. Now it's mostly via email. Joy even got alerted he was accepted to a school via text message. This means decisions land in students' inboxes at all hours, including during the school day or out with their friends, rather than reading a snail mail letter at home in the evening. Whitney Young High School senior Joe Radinsky found out he wasn't accepted early to the University of Chicago right after school, standing on an L train platform. He'd been waiting all day for that email. It was bad and a blow to his ego.
Like, I sort of deflated, and sort of for the next 2 days, I was like, what did I do wrong? Like, what about me isn't enough?
Some students tried to avoid opening these emails in public, waiting to get home. That didn't work for Keith Calloway. When Yale released their college decisions, the school sent a tweet saying decisions were out. He tried to wait until he got home.
But then 3 minutes later, I was like, okay, they're out. I can't take this. I have to know. And I logged in, and I saw that I got in. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I have to go.
He left class and called his family. But news travels fast.
As I was walking out, I saw some of my friends, and actually some of them overheard me on the phone, and by the time I hung up the phone, they had already, like, sent it to other people that, like, I had gotten into Yale.
That's another change. Everyone is sharing the news on social media as it happens. Senior Joe Radinsky says it took some time for him to adjust to the barrage of college news on his social media channels. It was hard to not take the updates personally.
And so when I see people, like, posting about other people's acceptances, like, normally I do have a gut reaction, and I'm not, like, super proud to say this, of just, like, yikes, like, what did I do? Like, what did I do wrong?
Some students post updates like 10 out of 10. That means they got into everywhere they applied. Others only share their acceptances on private Snapchat channels or Finstas, private Instagram accounts only shared with close friends. That's how Radinsky found out some friends were also deferred by the University of Chicago. They shared it privately. It made him feel a little better. It was nice to have friends going through the same thing. Now when he sees people post college news on social media, he has a different reaction.
I've been able to, like, grow from my first, like, what is this, like, reaction to, like, yes, like, good for you. Like, that's amazing.
Researchers say it's important to remember not all students use or are affected by social media in the same way. Adults should do more listening to figure out how to support them effectively. And kids, they say, should take more time to process before sharing. For Here and Now, I'm Kate McGee.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
It's been nearly 2 years since Hurricane Maria ravaged the island of Puerto Rico. Millions were left without power. Nearly 80% of the island's homes were damaged. And most importantly, of course, the Puerto Rican government says up to 3,000 people died. Well, now Puerto Rico is hoping tourism can help it rebuild. The organization Discover Puerto Rico has just launched a new ad campaign designed to lure travelers to the island. Here Now's media analyst John Carroll has been following this. And first of all, John, Puerto Rico is in the Caribbean, so I'm assuming that tourism is an important part of its economy.
It is an important part. According to Forbes.com, Puerto Rico typically gets about 5 million visitors a year. They spend nearly $4 billion, so that's about 8% of the island's economy.
And we're also seeing that just 6 months after Maria hit, over 85% of the island's hotels were fully operational again. So has the tourism come back to where it needs to be?
It's come back significantly. So according to the organization Discover Puerto Rico, the lodging demand is back to pre-Maria levels.
Huh.
Independent rentals, which I think are Airbnb for the most part, yeah, are up by 72%, and they think they're going to get an even bigger bump this year.
Why do they need the ad campaign then?
Well, they need the ad campaign because the organization did a study and found that Puerto Rico's brand image in the mind of most people in the U.S., the mainland, is pretty neutral. They don't understand why they would pick Puerto Rico over any other vacation destination in the Caribbean. So they're rolling out an ad campaign with digital ads, with social media ads, pre-roll ads on internet videos.
And I think we've got one of the TV ads here.
Welcome to Puerto Rico, your neighbor just to the south. We are waiting to welcome you to our home. Can we offer you something to eat or drink? A rhythm to dance to? Full of new faces and places to discover. We welcome you with open arms and even bigger hearts. Have we met yet?
John, it's Friday afternoon. I'm ready to go to Puerto Rico. Look, we can't see that ad, but this one begins with a series of colorful doors. Of course, that's a hallmark of old San Juan. Those doors are opening onto beaches and cobblestone streets. It's very nice.
Right, right. A number of TV spots are just beauty shots of the island with set to music. One spot lists Puerto Rico's best destination recommendations from about 20 publications. If you look at their YouTube channel, there are three dozen videos, among them Discover Puerto Rico with Lin-Manuel Miranda, and one behind the scenes with Jimmy Fallon. I'm not sure why Jimmy Fallon is involved in that.
He's funny, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
Beyond those pretty pictures, though, it seems like this campaign wants the audience to understand something important for travelers, which is that Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory.
Yeah, hard to believe there'd be any confusion about that, right? But the campaign wants to remind people that you don't need a passport to go to Puerto Rico. You can use U.S. currency, and most people speak English. So those are definitely benefits for the traveler.
Okay, quickly, the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello, has complained that he's still waiting for most of the disaster relief funds that were allocated by Congress for the storm. Any potential downside to this upbeat campaign trying to get people to
This is sort of a tale of two Puerto Ricos, one that's open for business to tourists and is looking great, the other where there are regular power blackouts where people are living beneath tarps. So you have to wonder if people might not get the wrong idea about the overall situation.
John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
Cyclone Fani slammed into the east coast of India today with winds gusting more than 120 miles per hour and torrential rain. More than 1 million people have been evacuated. The BBC's Divya Arya joins us now from Delhi. Divya, we know your colleague Raul Tandon is in Odisha state where the cyclone hit and his hotel roof collapsed. What else are you hearing about damage there?
Well, the damage is very extensive, especially in low-lying areas where people have been evacuated from. Fishermen have been advised not to step into the sea, of course, but we've also heard reports that some people refused to move away because they wanted to be close to their boats, to their belongings. It's difficult to confirm what situation they are in, as the gusty winds uprooted scores of trees, brought down electricity poles, and power supplies and phone lines have been badly affected.
Can you give us a sense of the geography there? What part of India is this and how populated is it?
Well, this is the eastern coast of India. Odisha is one of the poorest states of India, and it sees such cyclones pretty regularly. And this storm will move northwards towards the state of Bengal and then into Bangladesh. So it is an area which has experienced this earlier, and that is why there was this huge preparation made to make sure that there is less loss of life.
Let's talk about that. Ahead of the storm, as we said, more than 1 million people evacuated. How large of an undertaking was that, and where did all the people go?
It is one of the most massive exercises of evacuation that we've seen even in India. The last one we saw was in 2013, again in the wake of such a storm. And because of the evacuation exercise, many lives could be saved. And the impact of such a storm, I'd like to remind you that in 1999, when we did not have these systems in place, almost 8,000 lives were lost in Odisha, in the same state that we're talking about, because of a huge huge cyclonic storm. So this time, India was very prepared. And this is despite the fact that India is in the middle of an election period. Mm. Thankfully, Odisha has already voted, and the southern states where the coastal areas have seen, you know, gusty winds and high waves, they've also voted. So that part of, you know, the people could be the personnel from the National Disaster Management Authority or the local police, etc., could be deployed in these efforts. Some 3,000 buildings have been used to house the people who have been evacuated. These are permanent shelters like schools and government buildings, because a lot of people in the low-lying areas live in thatch roof houses and mud houses. So these shelters, these structures are not very permanent in nature, which is why there is a lot of danger if they would keep staying there when the cyclone made landfall. So they've been moved to these places. We've been seeing footage coming via news agencies throughout the day today. Helicopters are being loaded with relief supplies so that they can be airdropped to various places and even to the schools and these other permanent structures which are being used as shelters in remote areas.
And those shelters must be quite full.
They are. In fact, we've seen pictures of women and children sort of crowded on the floors. Imagine a million people and 3,000 shelters. So you can imagine how crammed those spaces would be. But it seems from what we are hearing from people on the ground as well, that there has been a lot of support from authorities. And it seems that India has been able to at least take care of an initial impact of the cyclone. But as it recedes, we'd get to know what the impact has been, especially on property.
Well, as you say, this is a very poor part of the country. Many of the homes are simply thatched roofs. They could have just completely vanished in this storm. We will find out. But what is next in terms of emerging from these shelters, people getting back into the area? What will they be facing?
Well, the people who generally get evacuated to such shelters are, of course, coming from the poorest of the poor, people who are daily wage labor and with very little means. And this can really set them back.
That's the BBC's Divya Arya in Delhi reporting on Cyclone Fani, which has slammed across India's eastern coast. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, now to Davenport on the eastern edge of Iowa, where the Mississippi River is cresting today at 22.7 feet. It's the highest level ever recorded, higher even than during the region's historic floods in 1993. On Tuesday afternoon, a temporary barrier broke with little warning. Now much of downtown Davenport is underwater. Joining us is Mayor Frank Klipsch. Mayor, thanks for making time to speak with us.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and letting the world know that we are open for business in Davenport, but we have some challenging times and we've got a great team coming together to deal with them.
Can you tell us what happened? The city had deployed these temporary flood barriers along the Mississippi riverfront. Why did they fail?
Well, I think, first of all, it's understanding we have embraced the river for many, many years. We have 9 miles of parkland and parks, so a lot of the pictures show a lot of those park areas underwater. Then the flood barriers were put in place outside of that realm, and then a small section of that, after being up for 40 days, which is a long time, breached. And it basically flooded, in addition to that wide parkland coverage of water, it flooded about a 2.5 to 3 block, square block area. So it's a little misleading that the whole city is not underwater, but a section of it is, and that, of course, is very important to us. And,
because that's the downtown area, right? I mean, there's a lot of businesses down there. There's you know, a lot of work that needs to be done in that area.
Exactly.
What are you seeing?
Well, it's the southeast part of downtown. Most of our businesses are still open. Some of these are on the southeast portion of it. We evacuated about 30 to 40 residents from that area who lived in some condo areas there. Some of the businesses are closed and waiting. They're already looking at coming back for recovery efforts. And we deal with that each year. But this was an unexpected breach, and a lot of water got into that area.
Well, why was it unexpected? Those barriers had been out for, as you say, 40 days. Did they just lose their strength? Was the river too much for them? What actually happened?
It's a little early to make that final determination. But again, when they're up that long, an excessive amount of rain, we had rain actually coming down the hill in towards the river. So we're still exploring what really happened. But this, again, is a relatively small portion of those barriers. There's still a significant amount of those up and are doing a great job as they were intended to do.
How are the Quad City River Bandits doing? I know that's your minor league baseball team. The stadium is right there along the river in that park that you described earlier.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting because we do a great job usually. There are ball games with the park in the middle of the river. And what happens, we have a walkway that goes over the water because it doesn't get up into the city quite as far as it has did this year. And the games go on with the flood all the way around it. This year, the water got about 22.7 feet, which is almost 7.5 feet above flood stage. It just got more than we could get the people in the ballpark. So we're ready for them to get back into town. They've been playing and doing pretty well, but in other people's ballparks, and we're hoping they'll get back as soon as possible.
So you want them home. Now, I ask you about the baseball team because the stadium, as we mentioned, is in this riverfront area that was developed over the years instead of a permanent flood wall. And as you well know, Davenport is no stranger to catastrophic flooding, including in the early 1990s. Do you think it's time to build a more substantial flood wall along the river in that area?
We will explore that after we get through this current situation. But we have made an attempt, and I'm also the co-chair of the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative, all 88 mayors from Minnesota to Louisiana. And we're trying to find ways, resilient ways, of dealing with the flood water without building up a big wall and forcing our problems downriver. So our parkland has been a great way to do that. Let it come out of the banks, deal with it along the river, and then when it recedes, we deal with that in other protected wetlands area that we're working on as well. Some of the businesses that have actually been affected, and I've talked to a lot of them, said, hey, we don't want a flood wall.
I was going to ask that. Don't you think that the businesses that are now, some of them are inundated, don't they want a better solution than just a temporary wall?
Well, actually, one of the reasons they're there is they want to be on the river and see the river. If you put up a wall, they don't want to have a beautiful restaurant overlooking a wall. They were on local media last night saying, nope, we don't want a flood wall. We deal with this. This happens. And 98% of the time, the river is beautiful and we want to enjoy it. We need to be able to maybe find enhanced ways to deal with this on a temporary basis. So we'll explore all of those as we move forward.
We see in the forecast more rain early next week. When will this water subside?
It will be dependent on the rain, as you'd mentioned. We're going to have 3 or 4 days of dry weather, so hopefully we'll see a slight receding of go below the crest. All of the infrastructure is holding. So if it does, hopefully, goes down some, and if it does rain, we'll have some room to be able to deal with that additional rain.
All right, we're hoping to. Frank Klipsch, mayor of Davenport, Iowa, where the Mississippi River is at the highest level ever recorded and has flooded parts of the downtown. Mayor, we wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
There's a new documentary out on Netflix this week that tracks last election's grassroots effort to inject fresh blood into Congress. Knock Down the House follows four Democratic insurgent hopefuls during the 2018 primary race. All four candidates are women, and each of them is challenging an incumbent Democrat, but only one would win.
And here's the best part about all of this. We're not running to make a statement. We're not running to pressure the incumbent to the left. We're running to win.
That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's at the center of this film, which follows her rise from obscurity to political celebrity and into Congress. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching this documentary. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
So filmmakers started following Ocasio-Cortez long before she would become known as AOC and a hero to progressives on the left. Remind us how this started and how she was actually recruited to run.
Sure. Well, my sense is that this documentary probably started as an attempt to take a look at the effort to challenge incumbent Democrats who are portrayed in this film, certainly, and are thought by many progressive activists to kind of be prisoners of institutional interest. And they have this ethic that every candidate talks about having average people being led by average people. So Ocasio-Cortez, we see her in her job as a barback, you know, polishing glasses and things like that. And we also see her going door to door just a year ago. You know, this was April of last year. She was collecting signatures to get on the ballot with her niece, you know, and no one knew who she was. And her story forms the spine of this documentary now. And we're constantly checking back in with her. And so it's not as much of a surprise when you see her victory at the end. But we have a little bit of a clip of her sort of articulating her reasons for running. So let's check it out.
I just want to thank everyone here so much. I mean, this is the work. What I do is just talk to people all the time, just members of our community all the time. And that is the organizing and that is the work of running a grassroots campaign. This is not just about Democrat versus Republican. In fact, it's so far away from that. This is not left or right. It's up and down.
Eric, because the filmmakers started this so early in the process, as you said, not long ago, nobody knew her name. These guys had no idea that she would end up where she did. So it kind of makes it a rare coming-of-age story that is unfolding before your eyes.
Well, I mean, it certainly makes the documentary more interesting than it would have been if all four women had lost their races. By being on the ground floor with each of these candidates, if any one of them had managed to unseat a really entrenched Democratic incumbent, it would have been a huge story. And so in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's example, the camera follows her on election day when she casts her vote for herself. There's nobody around. Hmm. There's no press there.
Nobody thought she would win.
They seem to be the only camera there. And then they follow her during that day. She didn't seem to want to hear any reports on how she was doing. And she doesn't have any idea that she's winning. And then she sees the results on a television screen, and that's the moment when she realizes that she might actually win this thing. They were there in crucial moments, and they were able to capture images that no one else has, as far as I know.
So winning makes good TV, but this documentary also includes the stories of the losers. Why do that?
Well, I think it's important because this was part of a larger movement, and in a lot of ways, it was important to see average people who were stepping up to try and run, and to see the mountain of challenge that was presented to them when they tried to challenge an entrenched, experienced legislator in their district. And these other women's stories are very compelling. There's one woman in Nevada, Amy Villela, whose daughter died because they weren't insured and a hospital wouldn't take care of her when she was having symptoms of a medical problem. And so she decided to run against an incumbent to try and get some progress made on insuring the uninsured or the underinsured. And so there's plenty of stories like this in this doc that's important to see so that people see that it's part of a larger dynamic inside the Democratic Party.
But did Netflix just produce a documentary that will only be of interest to Democrats?
Well, some conservative groups have criticized the documentary. There's a group called the Jog Creators Network that put out some press release. But this is a documentary about conflict inside the Democratic Party. And given that the Democrats took control of the House in the midterm elections, there's a sense that you have to pay some attention to what's going on inside the Democratic Party. You know, the tug of war between entrenched, you know, sort of middle-of-the-road Democrats and progressives who want the party to be more aggressive and move further to the left, that's a big story, and they seem to have encapsulated that in the stories they're telling in this documentary.
Right, that rift seems to be opening up a little bit wider every day. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans speaking to us about Netflix's new documentary, Knock Down the House. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.